Welcome to Wellness Spring. In this episode, get ready for an inspiring conversation with one of Australia's most respected soil microbiologists, Dr. Mary Cole. From breaking barriers as a young woman in agriculture to pioneering no-till farming before it was mainstream, Mary's journey is one of grit, vision and science in action. We'll discover how her award-winning work is transforming soil health and why it matters for human health and how our hands-on teaching and mentoring continue to shape the future of farming. This is a must listen for anyone who cares about their health and the ground beneath their feet. Welcome, Mary, to Wellness Spring. It's so lovely to have you on the show.
Thank you, Beverly. Thank you for having me. It's a great pleasure to talk with you.
Oh, I'm really excited. I've got a long list of questions that people have been sending me. And before, I know you've got such a remarkable story. So before we delve into any questions, would you like to tell the listeners how your story began, where you grew up, and what sparked your interest in the mysterious world beneath our feet?
Well, I grew up on the Atherton Tablelands in far north Queensland. My dad had a dear old Indigenous friend with whom he gardened for years. And I guess my introduction was a very, very small child squishing around in the soil, but also going out and foraging for mushrooms and collecting wood in the forest. And my dad having a great just appreciation and love for the countryside. And I remember, well, I'm not sure if I remember or whether it's been told to me, but as a four-year-old, he picked me up and he put our arms around a big eucalypt that had just lost its bark. And so it was beautiful and white. And he said, just put your ear here, Bub. This, he always called me Bub. To the day he died, he called me Bub. And he said, just listen, this is the spirit of the universe. And so I guess from that minute, looking at the soil, working at the soil with my father and his old friend, there was never any bare ground in our vegetable garden. There was never any weeds. There was never ever any pests. There was never any synthetic chemicals. Everything was natural. And so it was just obvious that my career had to be in science, it had to be in soil, and it had to be caring for our country. Then when I went to university, I found it very difficult because none of the universities actually taught the relationship between the soil, the microbes, and plant health. And so I found, so it was very much a journey of my own. And then that was why I started AgPath actually in 1980, so that I could provide a service for farmers and for anyone who was wanting to learn about that relationship between the soil and plants and plant health and no disease and no imported synthetic chemistry, just all natural. And I guess I've made it my life journey. We've been on our farm here for 53 years, never used a synthetic chemical on it. We've taken our organic matter from 12% up to 23. We don't have any weeds. We don't have any capeweed. We don't have any disease. And I think what we've done, and through my life, I've been able to establish and actually show that this concept of biological farming or regenerative agriculture, call it what you want, it doesn't matter what it's called, it's caring for the country. And it works. And I've proven it. And I've had a wonderful life because of it.
Wow, you covered a lot there, and that's amazing that you've done all this biological. So you were really well ahead of your time. And Could you let us know what were the biggest challenges you faced as a young woman stepping into a male-dominated world of agriculture?
Well, it certainly was male dominated, and I guess the thing that I found was, because my concept of farming was so outside the norm at the time, I was ridiculed by farmers, some farmers, most agronomists, all chemical companies, and there was many a field day that I walked away broken. But I wasn't going to let them show that they had affected me in such a way. And I was very lucky that I had wonderful mentors who said, just keep going, Mary, because one day you'll be on the right side of history. And I think that day has come.
Wow, yeah, I was going to ask you, how did you stay on the path?
It was hard. It was tough. It was tough.
So, what gave you the guts to keep going when the farming world said you can't?
I think what I saw as a child, the way my father and his old Indigenous friend just loved that there was such a love of the soil. And I just looking, having grown up with my father's vegetables, not having any synthetic chemistry, just Pooties and Wheaties and mulching and just everything that was natural. And we'd go down to the garden. It never occurred to us that we would have to wash anything because there was no poisons in the system. And so I saw that it worked. I knew that it worked. And then everywhere that I was, when we came to our farm here, I said, we decided immediately that we would try to make it a showcase of just natural farming methods. And no synthetic chemistry, and just using compost and compost tea and fish and kelp and mulches. And we've proven it. Our farm is a showcase, and people will come here and look at it and say, this is what it's supposed to be. So I just knew innately from that early childhood and that relationship with my dad and the old Indigenous man that there is no other way. There is no other way.
Yeah, and my partner and I grew up similar to you, where my father grew everything and he would get cow manure delivered twice a year, and he grew all our fruit and vegetables, and it was just a way of living. And an uncle had a beef farm and my grandmother chicken farm, so it was just lovely. But while my partner Brian and I came here after COVID, we were traveling around looking for land to build holistic retreats, but we were just devastated by the amount of degradation that we saw around Australia. And then we started meeting amazing people like Peter Andrews and
Yes.
wonderful
Colin
people.
Sice. Colin
Yes, yeah
Sice. Yes, yes,
yeah
yeah.
and
Wonderful.
it's just been amazing, and our path's taken a different trajectory, because I love the way you said it, your dad said to hold the tree and the world is inside it, because I work spiritually and energetically, and I could feel Mother Earth crying,
Absolutely.
so. And you talk about synthetic chemicals, because as you know, everything is chemicals, but the
That's right.
synthetic chemicals are what destroying our land. So you've got your place showcased. Peter Andrews had his, and Charlie Massey, there's a long list of people who have got the evidence. So why do you think it is that the government are not encouraging people, or who or what is blocking this from happening? Because the yield and the produce is so much better.
It is, but when the universities don't teach or alternative methods of farming, and their agronomists are coming out in a purely chemical, synthetic chemical paradigm with ploughing the soil, getting as much production without any thought of destruction being caused. The chemical companies are very powerful. You know, I've been up in the court against Monsanto, and it is not easy. They are brutal, and we've got to have politicians that have a backbone, and to say that the United Nations declaration that if we don't change our farming practices, we've got probably 60 harvests left. You know, now 60 is it's, I mean, it's just a figure, but the thing is, it's a wake up call. We don't have time. And so the chemical companies, even now, I know some of them are starting to realize that they have to start to bring biological in, because the movement is not from the top. The movement is from the people, and the people have got to demand, and which they're doing, clean food. And so the chemical companies know that their life expectancy is short, not short enough, but it's short. And so they're starting to make that change. So I think it's a transition. And I guess in the time, if you think about Mother Earth, it's a blink. She'll recover. But we're a generation where we can actually help her to recover. And people are starting to listen because grassroots people are starting to demand clean food. Children are ill, not because of anything their parents have done, but because of the appalling quality of fruits and vegetables that are going through the supermarkets. So I think the move is there, but it has to be from the people. It's not going to come from the top. And it's like everything. When you have a grassroots movement, somewhere along the train, the politicians will start making laws or put into place reasons why farmers should have the benefit of going that way. The other thing is, in Australia, Australian farmers don't have any subsidies. Yeah, for the rest of the world, there are subsidies. It's terrible. Australia's farmers are the most efficient in the world. They are the best in the world, but they get no thanks for it.
I know, and I think people don't realise the hard work that farmers do. And as we've been travelling and meeting lots of farmers, the majority of them are so exhausted, you know. And as you know, once every 10 days, a farmer's committing suicide.
Exactly, exactly. Because they see no future. They are not given a reason to try and get some sort of future on their land, because they are encouraged to use synthetic fertilizer. That synthetic fertilizer has to be paid for. The supermarkets won't pay a realistic price for their produce. And they're working 365 days a year to do that. They have no incentives in this country. And that is a tragedy, because the only reason people can live in cities is because there's a farmer on the land working 7 days a week.
Yeah, and you mentioned, you know, I love that email you sent me, soil health equals plant health equals gut health. And
absolutely.
Stuff up one part and the rest is stuffed. So can you unpack that for us?
Well, Mother Nature has everything in balance. There's nothing exists in nature that doesn't have a role. So there's no freeloaders in nature. And nature has all of the minerals, the elements for any plant to be healthy. As soon as we plow the field, we lose all of that microbiology. We then put in synthetic chemicals. So there's elements missing. So it means that the fruits, the vegetables, the animals that live then on that disturbed soil and disturbed land are not getting the total range of nutrition that they should be getting. And so if you then translate that into the fact that animals and humans eat both the meats and the fruits and vegetables, then it means that the diversity that Mother Nature gave has been reduced because of they've been poisoned out of existence. And then it means that the foods that one takes in The gut biome in both the animals and the humans is also depleted. So if you have a depleted and ineffective gut biome, then illnesses, diseases, autoimmune diseases, all these sorts of little syndromes that affecting children or affecting population today, a lot of that can go back to the fact that they don't have a decent, diverse gut biome. But put them back onto an organic farm, the change is phenomenal and in a short time. And we have children coming here saying, or people coming here, and we're saying, they're saying, what's wrong with your strawberries? What's wrong with your tomatoes? They taste different. I said, no, they taste like they're supposed to taste. You just are not getting that from the material, the stuff that you're buying in the shops that is all synthetic chemistry generated. No flavor, no nutrition, poor gut biome. Go back to organics and you get the lot.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, disease, like especially with children, it's the highest it's been in history for the last 15 years with, you know, autism and diabetes and even cardiac health and the cancers. And yeah, so what do you say to people who say, I can't afford organic?
I say to them, organic, you don't have to eat as much because you get better nutrition. But if you can't afford to buy organic, and I mean, that's the travesty. It shouldn't be more expensive, but it's probably more realistic price. You've got a pot plant at your back door. Grow a lettuce in it. Grow a tomato in it. Grow a potato in it. Get a couple of more little pot plants and grow some things. Okay, you're not going to grow your whole range of fruits and vegetables, but if you can bring into your daily diet radishes, lettuce, tomatoes, things that will grow quickly and short season, then you're starting to reintroduce that diversity into your gut biome. So to me, people are now so removed from their source of food. They don't know that instead of putting a flower in a pot plant, they could put a tomato plant. So I say to them, go get. And then they say, oh, I live in a flat. And I say, I work in Singapore. We've got vertical gardens. Make yourself a vertical garden. I work in, they said, oh, we don't have any good soil. I work in the UAE and in Egypt. We've got desert sand. We're growing beautiful fruits and vegetables, biodynamically, I might add, in Egypt. So don't tell me it can't be done. It can be done. You just got to want to do it. And pot plants are a good way to start.
Yeah, and I think, like you said, when you mentioned about the taste, like a friend of mine said to me, and also Rachel Ward, when I interviewed her, she said, everybody is so used to chemical flavors now, you know, all the synthetic flavors. She said, even her cows, before she changed from conventional farming, she said they'd be, you know, panting, waiting for the chemicals. So it's addiction. And people are not used to that glorious, delicious taste of healthy food. And like you said, they think there's something wrong. And I know a friend of mine just moved into an apartment. She downsized in Newtown, and she's in Sydney. She started a vertical garden there. And now her neighbours are going, how are you doing that? Yeah. So I know you were experimenting way before others with no tilling, and long before it became the buzzword. So what inspired you to take that leap, and how was it received at the time?
Well, it was laughed at and ridiculed mercilessly. It was. I guess it comes back to what I, the only thing I ever knew, in my father's garden, there was everything growing. And he didn't see weeds as problems. He saw them as nutrient sources for his garden. He saw them as the potential to make weed teas and put the nutrients back. So in his garden, there was never bare land. There was never bare space. It always had something in it. And so I'm used to that concept of having 100% cover 100% of the time, because that's what Mother Nature doesn't have bare patches. Unless there's been a volcanic explosion or there's been a landslide, there is no bare, there's no bare soil, well, except where humans have made it bare. But Mother Nature has a cover over all of the time, because there's that beautiful mycorrhizal fungi that's on the plant roots that's been around for over 500 million years, that holds water, that holds nutrients, that holds carbon. It's the way I grew up. I grew up to see the land always covered with something growing. And so it seemed the obvious thing. If that made healthy food with no pests and diseases, then obviously if we did that on our farm and we use a yeoman's plough, where we just aerate the soil, why would you go and plough up soil and lose all those beautiful microbes? Because it's not sustainable. And it's been proven that it's not sustainable. So I guess, Beverly, it was all I ever knew.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, because like, again, traveling around Australia, not only Australia, we traveled around Europe last year, and we are travelers, we're nomads. It's just heartbreaking seeing brown, barren lands everywhere. And it's a no-brainer. People talk about climate change and it's like, hello, man is affecting it, and they don't put the dots together.
It has been so destructive and so pervasive. It's been driven by profit for chemical companies, not for farmers. It's been driven by profit. And I guess all of those sorts of civilizations that are exploitative all have to come to an end sometime. And I think we're seeing the end of this kind of exploitation of Mother Earth. It's not sustainable.
Exactly, like you said, 60 harvests, and some people are telling me even less than that, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
So you'd think the alarm bells would be ringing worldwide and people actively making change happen.
There are wonderful, people around the world, and unfortunately, not many of them are in Australia, except the ones that you've listed. But there are groups around the world that are way, way, way ahead of Australia in protecting their soil, in having some humility, and understanding that it's a privilege to live on this earth. You know, we're not here to exploit it. That's not our right. And so these people in these organizations with the United Nations and other countries in Africa and Asia, they're beginning, or they always have appreciated what they have. And so we in Australia are so far behind, and it's heartbreaking.
Yeah, I believe Australia is one of the few countries in the world that hasn't banned any pesticides or herbicides for the last 30 years, you know.
And yet it's interesting. There's more organic agricultural land in Australia than any other country, but that's because we have the space. So it's not that it's not being done. It always seems to be the periphery, when in effect it should be mainstream. And we need governments to help us get it mainstream, because it is sustainable. The agronomists that come out of universities these days, they say, oh, well, pasture cropping, etc., you can't feed the world. You absolutely can feed the world. And there's been studies. I mean, the 30-year Rodale report from Pennsylvania proves that this sort of regenerative agriculture, you get a crop every year. With the destruction of ploughing and conventional agriculture, you can't get a crop every year. So if you look at that over the long term, and then look at the way that the land is destroyed by conventional it's time for conventional ploughing, that sort of agriculture, to become periphery because we can feed the world.
Absolutely, totally agree. And I really want to congratulate you on your prestigious AgriFutures Rural Women's Award in Victoria recently.
It is. I was very proud of that. Yes. And just at the moment, I'm working hard to make my pitch in Canberra on the, I think it's the 24th of July, where all of these wonderful women from the different states and territories will all be meeting. We'll meet, well, for me, I'll be meeting them for the first time. I've only met them online, and they're awe-inspiring, all of them. Yes, I think it's the 24th of July we make our pitch for the national. So I'm
Oh,
hoping that I can
wow.
do Victoria proud.
I'm sure you will. And what does this acknowledgement mean to you personally and professionally?
Think personally, for me, it's a vindication that my old mentors, sort of 40 years ago, said that one day you'll be on the right side of history. I think I am, and I'm proud of myself to have had the courage to rise above all of the criticism that I have endured in the past, not so much today, but in the past. And so for me personally, that is. Now professionally, I think I'm hoping that the fact that what I've been trying to do is recognized at the state level, at least, will have people see that this is important, that this is the way that we could maybe go into the future. Because why recognize what I'm doing if it doesn't have a value? So I think what the awards have done is, in my mind, put a value on what I've been trying to do, and hopefully people will see that.
Yes, absolutely. And as you said, when you started out, women weren't even recognized in agriculture. And is there one myth you'd like to smash about women in agriculture?
Women can do anything. And women have always been in agriculture. They're just like everything else, they've been written out of history. If you think about the last 250 years, the women of early white settlement, they were the ones that were left on the farms when the husbands went off to wars, etc. Women have always been in agriculture. Women will always be in agriculture, and women will be the leaders if they're allowed to be in agriculture in the future.
So, how can women bring something different, maybe even better, to the future of farming? And I think when you said allow, that triggered me to saying, well, we're all equal, we're all human.
We are, but women have to be twice as good in everything they do, and they are. I think they have to be there and allow their voices to be heard. And how women can change is women are more empathetic. Women want their children to be healthy. Women do the correct thing. They just don't have access to the foods, etc., to allow them to be the best they can be. So if women are in decision-making areas, at whatever level in society, then they're going to demand that their children live a healthy life and they have a planet that is worth inheriting. And only women have that empathy. Some men do, and some wonderful men do, but women have the empathy for Mother Earth. To make a future for their children.
I totally agree with that. And because mothers will go to the end of the earth and do whatever it takes for their children. So
That's right.
what would be your message to the next generation of fearless female farmers who would want to do things differently?
Do it. Do
Great.
it. Just do it. The ridicule and the negativity is usually generated from ignorance. So educate. Women are great educators, and just prove by example. This is what we've done on our farm. I can go out and talk. I said, just come and have a look at our farm. This is proof. So women, just do it. You can do it.
Oh, that's a wonderful message. Like Nike, just do it. And looking back, what do you wish someone had told you as a woman just starting out on the land?
I think I didn't realize how hard the journey was going to be. And what I hope in my career that the journey is going to be easier for young women today. But although I was given the advice, just keep on, I didn't realize just how hard it was going to be. And I just hope I've been a pioneer to make it easier for young women in the future. But it's not going to be easy because we still have to have our voices heard.
Yes, this is the biggest challenge to get our voices heard. So maybe, through you and pioneers like you, people coming together, we can all stand as one voice.
I hope so. I hope so. And just appreciate. Get rid of those egos and just appreciate what a privilege it is to live on this earth.
Absolutely. And as you know, I've just purchased land with my partner, and absolutely, this is our first week here, and absolutely loving it. And we're making a plan. So I'm one of those ladies just starting out, and we do plan to grow hemp, as I mentioned to you.
Oh,
So,
good. Yes.
yes. So, what advice would you give to us and the listeners if they want to grow hemp?
Well, the industrial hemp is certainly recognized by agri-futures as an emerging industry, and it has so many benefits, both for recovering soil that's broken, for getting an income stream that's other than the sort of primary income stream, because you can get probably two crops a year in most areas. The other thing about it is that it gives you access to actually a third stream of income, which is carbon trading, should you wish to go down that way. But it's more that it gives farmers an option of getting a rapid return, because 140 days is what they say is about the length of the crop. And it's not a difficult crop to grow, and it doesn't require a lot of water, and it's pretty well pest free. And we're in that situation at the moment, a little bit of a catch 22. We need more hemp being grown so that we can process it here. We can't get the processing because we don't have enough hemp being grown. So we need people like you to start bringing hemp production into the market so that we can get the manufacturers a security to get this hemp industry going, because it will release lots of food products back into the food chain, because we can make biofuels from it. There's so many things. What 26,000 products or something can be made from industrial hemp?
Yeah, something
And
crazy.
yeah, and so imagine all our clothing from this beautiful, clean, non-synthetic, being able to keep coal in the ground where it should be. So it's getting your license all in place for whatever state you're in. And then, yes, talking to people who are growing it in your area, and yeah, go for it. There's
Yeah.
it's it's we can't we we we're just not growing enough at the moment to be able to get the industry into its like into that next phase of success.
Yeah, I read an article about hempcrete to because I want everything to be sustainable and eco-friendly and bio on the land, and the article was pertaining to that the government want to have more tests done to make sure that the buildings will be safe and secure and reach the building standards. Yet in Canada and many other countries, they're already approved, and there's a lot of regulations stopping the production of certain things.
It's certainly difficult, but I belong to the Australian Industrial Hemp Alliance, and many of the members on that commit that particular alliance are also on the International Industrial Hemp Alliance, as I am on the soil one. And yes, we're working with government to change those aspects that are sort of roadblocks. We're working with the APVMA and things like that are making it easier for getting the products accepted. And again, it's a journey, Beverly. It's a journey. It's a very new industry in Australia. And yes, governments seem to be risk averse. But it's it for a building product, the hempcrete, it's fireproof. I mean, we it, you know, every house in a fire risk area around the world should be either made of hempcrete or at least have a fireproof room in it that's made of hempcrete. No, it's a given. The tests for fire retardant is already been done. It was done up in New South Wales, I believe. So it's a case of we have to keep pushing. And this is again one of those grassroots things. The farmers need to push to make it easier to grow this product, to release, to get it, because it's such a sustainable product. Clothing, we don't need plastics. We've got to get rid of plastics. We've destroyed the world with plastics, and yet we have these beautiful products to make clothing, just beautiful clothing. Oh,
And
it drives me crazy.
yeah, I'm also an aromatherapist. So for me, I like to make healing balms and blends,
Yes,
and because the powers of it is so amazing.
absolutely.
But regarding the soil, because you talked a lot about the microbiome, so I believe, you have to have a certain test done. So what would we need? And can
Well,
hemp grow on any land?
it's fairly forgiving, but we have. I mean, this is part of what my laboratory does. Is we have for the last, oh gosh, 30 or 40 years, tested the soil biota and the activity, and we usually say to our farmers, a baseline, which is what we're starting with. Which will tell us what activity and what chemistry you have there, and then we use that as a baseline to then just de design. I only ever design regenerative biological farming methods, and then we go on and we design what the land might be lacking because of how it's like its history. And then after a couple of years, gosh, you're away because you're making your compost and you're using your fish and kelp and molasses and you don't have any disease, so you're not inputting anything synthetic. So this is what this is why I established AgPath.
Yeah,
So
can
that
you tell
I
us
can
a bit?
go on.
Sorry. Yeah, I was just going to say, could you please tell us about AgPath? You mentioned it a few times, your lab, and how that started.
Well, I started because there was no alternative to biological testing, and so in the lab here, we're fiercely independent, and so we do a lot of soil health analysis. We do plant health analysis. We do disease identification, and then we provide sort of whole farm planning programs for farmers to make the transition to biological or permaculture or biodynamic. Well, call it what you will, regenerative. What it is we don't work with anybody really who is a fully synthetic chemistry paradigm. We try to encourage people and teach them how to transition. And then farmers are really happy once they have that knowledge. they go ahead and they're fine. But we provide, and then, you know, maybe once a year at the same time each year, they'll send in a soil sample just to see how their soil biota is recovering with the new methods of farming that they've got. And so we provide that service. We do a lot of expert witness work. We work with some of the big sort of companies that might be hydroponic or whatever. We do whatever we can, but always our encouragement is to go down the more natural, less synthetic mm-hmm. input pathway. And so we provide the biology testing to do that, which is some of our major work.
And it's great that you said that you're completely independent, because what a lot of people say, you know, you can't rely on scientific testing today because it depends on who's paying the scientists. So
Exactly. And that's why we've always been fiercely independent. And then, of course, the other major part of it is all our education work. We have workshops every couple of months. I have students coming here doing summer scholarships, and they're some of the vet students that are doing who have an agricultural component to their high school. I have year 10 students coming here. I have university students, graduates coming here because they haven't learned anything about soil biology. So we do a lot of educational work. And then the farmers come to the workshops, the weekend workshops, and go away happy little chappies and spread the word.
Yeah. So I know you invited Brian and I to a workshop. Would you like to
Absolutely.
Tell the listeners more about that?
Well, the workshop, we have them on weekends, and that the reason for that is that it suits most people. And so what we do on a Saturday is the beginning of it is kind of, I call it a lecture, but really it's a talk about understanding the soil microbes and what role they have in just soil health and plant health and gut biome. Then we actually make a small cubic meter compost ring that's able to be very easily controlled to make high quality compost that will make compost tea that will take the place of synthetic chemistry in disease management. So that's the Saturday. And then Alan puts on the most wonderful morning tea, lunch and afternoon tea by one of our local little cafes. And then I make the soup, so it's all organic. And then on Sunday, we have a day where the people participants bring in their compost or their soils, and they're taught how to use a microscope correctly. And then they actually taught how to identify the important microbes that are in their soil or their compost or their compost tea. And so they take away a little manual that has identification in it. And so then they may, and many of them do, go and buy their own microscope, and they set it up, and then they've got their microscope booklet, and they can identify, and they go off and they're on the journey to a healthy soil and a good compost. And so we do all of that. They're very big weekends. They start at 8 and they finish at 5. Everybody is very happy and full of good food and lots of good information. And they start, the people who come start their own little group network and share information after that, which is wonderful.
That's lovely. And even if you just had your home little garden, could you do this workshop as well?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I have many gardeners coming along, and there's different ways of making their compost that they can scale up or scale down for whatever their size is. I mean, I have a little 20-liter bucket that we make compost tea in. And then I was over talking to some broadacre farmers up in way up in the Murchison area, and I was banging on about my wonderful 1,000-litre vat. And they sort of tapped me on the head and said, "Oh, Mary, that's not a vat. This is a vat. And here they are making compost tea in 30,000-litre old winery vats. Beautiful compost tea." So it was sort of, you know, it was kind of my Crocodile Dundee moment. You know, that's not a knife, Mary. So now I say, now for me, 1,000 liters is fine, but when you've got 10,000 hectares, I quite understand why 30,000 liters is a little bit more appropriate. It's a lot of fun. So yes, it doesn't matter. 20-liter bucket is fine.
Great. And what exactly are you putting into this compost tea?
We just use any carbon source, sort of any brown material, cardboard, newspaper, our twigs from the garden. Everything comes from off our own property. And so all of the brown material is your carbon source. And then our fresh grass, our vegetable scraps, etc., those that the chickens don't get, we will make into that becomes our nitrogen source.
And so
we keep a balance. There's a balance that gives you a good compost, which is a sort of a 20 to 30 to 1 carbon to nitrogen, and so we do that, but we try to do it with plant material, because when you start to introduce manures, which gives you more nitrogen, you start to introduce a level of more care that you have to take because of the presence of E. coli and Salmonella and things like that. So we tend not to use manures in our compost. We just do them with all plant material, or what was plant material. Yes.
Yeah. So I've seen a few tests, especially in America. You can do it yourself online and do your own testing of your soil. Would you recommend any of those? And what should we be looking at? What are we testing for when we look at the soil?
Oh, look, it's there's, yes, you can, because there was an amazing man in New Zealand who has what he calls a visual soil assessment. But the you put a spade in the ground, just do a square, lift up the soil very carefully. And I mean, I think the most important thing, indicator of how good your soil is how many earthworms do you have? If there's no earthworms, you've poisoned it. But you can bring that out, have a look at your earthworms, have a look at how deep your plant roots are going down into the soil. What's the texture of the soil? Has it got nice texture? There are a lot, and then the smell. I mean, just the smell alone can tell you whether your soil is good or not. The other thing is using, finding out how aerobic, how much air is in the soil, and just getting a strong piece of wire and pushing it down into the soil. When you start to meet real resistance, it means that you've probably got some sort of a hard pan there, which means that when the water and the roots meet that barrier, they start to go sideways. And so there are a lot of things like that you can do. You can go and buy a penetrometer. Yes, you can, but you don't need to. You can do it with just a strong piece of wire to see where you've got these areas where water is not going to penetrate and plant roots are not going to penetrate, and that's something that you're going to have to break up. The other thing is to never plow the soil. You simply open the soil with drill lines like a yeoman's plow. You never turn the soil. And that means you'll be able to keep your fertility. But just those visual things, what color is it? Is it mottled? Does it smell? It smell good. There is so much you can do, but particularly earthworms. Presence of earthworms is an absolute sign of good soil.
That's great. And if you haven't got good soil, you're going to rectify it with all the things that you just mentioned.
With compost and fish and kelp and molasses and rock dust, you don't need anything synthetic.
Yeah. Going back to the hemp, how much would you recommend planting when you first start out? 1 hectare or
Well, it's
1 acre?
all it's always unless you've got a lot of help from experienced growers, it's always good to sit to, I always say suck it and see, because I've put in we put in we had different varieties because we didn't know what variety would grow best where we are, so we had three or four varieties, and so we divided our hectare into three or four small lots. We've now found one that really does grow well now. So this year in September, I'm going to put in a hectare and just see how that goes, because my no-till farming is different from the way that other people do it. And so I'm wanting to see how that's going to go. So yes, start with a hectare, see how you go. See what work is involved. See whether you go out as soon as you get it in, you go out and you find a buyer for your crop. It's easier to do that. Our first crop, our first ones we put in, oh gosh, they're coming up beautifully. We went out the next day. The rabbits had eaten them all, hadn't they? So there was nothing there. So we had to actually fence against rabbits. And so, little things like that. Then we went into a drought. So we had where we had to water, we had to actually buy water to water. So, the little things like
God.
that. So for me, it's all a learning thing. So for me, I would say, yeah, put in a hectare
Yeah, okay.
and then see how it goes. Once you've got a supplier for your product, you know what variety is going to be best with you. You know how much work it has for your inputs. Then you can decide whether you go bigger. If it's all works out well, and you've got a supplier for your product at the end, whatever it happens to be in whatever form it's going to be, then you can go bigger. But you haven't lost anything if it doesn't work out.
Yeah. And what roughly would be the cost of starting up?
Well, first of all, you have to buy the seed, and then I suppose it depends on. And I'm not probably the best person here. There are other people who know better than I. But I've heard I'm he hearing them talking. Buying the seed is quite expensive. Good, and make sure you get good quality seed, because we were given some seed that was very, very low viability. Well, that's no good. And then whether you've got to hire plows and not plows, but hire a soil preparation, it's very variable. From a couple of thousand dollars up to several thousand dollars, but the return is much higher than that. I think I was told it could be up to $5,000 a hectare, or $3,000 to $5,000 a hectare. Don't quote me on that, because I'm not an expert, because I haven't got a crop yet. But the return is much higher than the input. But the input depends on whether you have to hire, or you've got to get someone to do the work for you, etc. There's a lot of variables there. But the return on the crop is much higher than the input. And particularly if you get two crops a year, then it really is a very good alternative. And then the other thing, if you're interested in going down that third line, that third stream, which is carbon trading, then hemp gives you that opportunity as well. So I haven't really given you an answer, because it's very variable.
Okay, no, but that's good. It's getting us thinking, and obviously we're reaching out to people and doing our background homework. And the same,
Go on.
I was going to say, we're doing the homework as well because we want to grow vegetables and fruit and nut trees, and
Yes.
it's knowing where to plant them and if our soil is good and checking with neighbors what they're growing and so forth. Because I've heard
Exactly.
you talk about the different microbiology that is needed in the soil for whether it's vegetables or fruit trees, for example.
Well, it's not so much that you need a different. What happens is nature's been there. She's done that, and what she does is, if the soil is in good condition, then the microbiology that's required by whatever the plant is that's growing at the time is all there. It's all there. It just increases or decreases or does the job or goes on holidays because it's not needed. But what you've got to do is make sure you have the diversity there in the first place. And this is why I always say get a baseline soil sample done.
Yeah.
So that you know what you've got, and then you know what to build. You know, you may have, if you've got weedy species, you've got a bacterial dominated soil. Well, you've got to get carbon in, and you've got to get your fungal component back in again. So the soil test will tell you if you have a lot of a particular protozoa, it means you've got compaction. So you need to aerate the soil. The soil test tells you so much about how to go forward.
And would we, how many soil tests would we need per hectare or
no, if you've got
no?
the you no per soil type. If your
Per soil
property is
type.
if your property is one soil type, then take a good on my website it actually tells you how to take your soil sample.
Okay.
And so you take a soil sample that represents your soil type, and that's all you need to do. Yeah, and then you send about a good generous half kilo to the lab, and the paperwork's all there. It's all there
great.
online, making it easy for you.
Yeah, because we've noticed some part of the land, we've got some wetland, and another part we've got taprock, and another part is similar to a Daintree forest, for example. You
Gosh,
know.
gosh. So there's
Yeah.
a lot of variation. Well,
Yeah.
the thing is, if you've got wet land, then
Yeah.
if that's a natural soak,
Yeah.
exploit that and make it into a habitat, a wetland habitat. If you've got rock near the surface, well then leave it there. If you've got rainforest, you know what I mean, you've got forest
Yeah.
area, leave it there and encourage it because that's wildlife habitat. And then
Yeah.
find a piece of land, a piece, you know, an area of your land where if you work with it, you're not going to be doing too much damage, but
Yeah.
you've got your other areas that are kind of offsetting your damage, if you know,
Yeah.
because much as soon as we start to put any sort of implement into the soil, we're doing some level of damage. What we have to do
Yeah.
is with the biological farming that I talk about is the damage is very quickly recoverable. Never back
Yeah.
to 100%, but it's very quickly recoverable because the diversity is there. And so I would be exploiting, as I say, you know, don't try and get rid of a wet area. It may be a natural soak. Exploit it. Make it into a habitat for wildlife. And
Yeah.
frogs.
Well, last year, the last 2 years, apparently pumpkins started growing there naturally. The farmer was didn't even plant any, and he said it happened again this year. He had a big field just full of pumpkins. So,
That happened to us with our tomatoes.
yes.
that yes no absolutely encourage it encourage it
Yeah.
yes
Yeah.
and any of your excess, take them to the food bank.
Yeah, and also because having worked with Peter Andrews, he always talks about managing your water. So there's many ways of slowing the water down, and you know where there's water, you can plant trees and so forth. Yeah.
That's right. That's right. Well,
So
all. Oh, sorry. Go on.
no, I was just going to conclude because I know we could talk for hours and
We
hours,
could
and
actually.
I'm super excited, and I know all the listeners will benefit from this. And what is the best way for them to reach out to you?
The best way is by an email, and it's
Okay.
just
No.
mary@agpath.com.au, and go to the website, which is www.agpath.ed. What is it? What is it?
.com.
www.com.au.
Yeah.
And I'm not good with the telephone because I simply don't have time. But emails, I always try to answer within 48 hours.
That's wonderful. And is there anything you'd like to share with the listeners before we say goodbye?
I think probably what I've said before, show some humility and appreciate that we have a wonderful opportunity on this planet, and she's absolutely worth being here if we just look and see.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And because it's a wellness show, what is your number one wellness go-to?
Fresh fruit and vegetables from my garden and eggs from my chickens, or my, no, Alan's chickens. They're Alan's chickens. They're in Hen Hilton. Fresh fruit, fresh vegetable. We don't eat processed food.
Thank you. You're remarkable, and all that wonderful advice is being incredible. So
Thank
wishing
you,
you,
Beverly. Yes,
thank you.
thank you.